Welcome to the morning show live from the Jack Daniel's Barrel House at Bridgestone Arena. Braden Gall here alongside Steve Lehman. You can follow him on Twitter at Steve Lehman. There's a Y in there, News Channel 5. Kevin Cow is engineering here, of course, and Julian Council producing back in the Game Nashville studios. Preds back on the ice tonight. Puck drop at 6. Pregame coverage at 6, puck drop at 7. Not sure what I was thinking there. Victor Arvidsson did need to be helped off the ice yesterday at practice. Not sure what that means. He's listed as day-to-day for the future of him. And then Philip Forsberg, of course, not skating with the team but doing some drills and puck handling a little bit there. We're still very much two and a half, three, maybe even four weeks away from him coming back. So that's a quick update on Predators practice yesterday as they got back on the ice. We'll talk with Chris Mason coming up in about 30 minutes about that big game against Vegas tonight as well. Joe Rexroad joining us here on the program. And Joe, you've covered a lot of different teams in a lot of markets. Where does this sort of last 4 or 5 weeks rank for you as far as, you know, interaction with general manager, front office, ownership, head coach, media? You put it all together and the roller coaster that has been the last 4 or 5 weeks. Have you seen anything like this?
Well, that's a good question, Braden. I mean, I still think college sports can be even wackier sometimes with the boosters and the ADs. And, I mean, even, you know, some of the stuff that I've seen in a short time here over at Tennessee. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever top the presser of announcing Fulmer, you know, and that coach search. But, yeah, this is pretty wacky. And as it turns out, you know, all that stuff was, I mean, you know, we can look back and say, yeah, Malarkey would have been gone if they lost to Jacksonville, and they were ready to fire him if he lost to Kansas City, and it ended up happening anyway. And, I think even in the locker room Saturday night, Braden, some of the players, Delaney Walkie in particular, look, when they were talking about Malarkey, it was like they were kind of saying, like they knew that it was over. And I think when he said what he said after the Kansas City game about, you know, how he didn't have support, you know, no one had showed him any support, and so he assumed the worst. You look at that, and it's like, yeah, how do you continue from that? So whatever the specifics were, and John Robinson wasn't totally clear on that, but whatever they were, this was just a relationship that had to end.
Yeah, it seemed like it was very toxic in the last couple of weeks because of all those circumstances leading up to this moment, Joe. What did you make about John Robinson's performance, if you want to call it, yesterday as he came out? Clearly it's his team. He was the only guy up there talking about this decision. He did not give us much of the specifics of why he actually made the decision other than he wanted another direction. But it is very clear he's the guy making the call moving forward to find that new direction. What did you make of that?
Yeah, and, you know, John Robinson's always – I mean, he's a no-nonsense guy, you know. He's a straightforward guy. But I thought that one thing that did strike me when I wrote that today is, you know, usually, you know, he's got a few jokes in there. Yesterday he was straight up – and, of course, it's a very serious matter. But, yeah, he didn't say much. He was very brief when talking about what happened with Malarkey. And I think he made it clear – I think it might have been clear anyway, but coming out of there, it was clear to me. You know, I mean, this is his show. You know, Amy Adams Strunk wasn't there when they fired Mike Malarkey, you know, or when they parted ways with Mike Malarkey. You know, it was John Robinson and Steve Underwood, and I believe that he. I don't know if some people are going to say, well, he won the power struggle to get rid of Malarkey because, you know, Amy Adams Strunk has been very close with him, and she decided to hire him back when they fired Ken Whisenhunt. I don't know if that's what it is, but I do know that this is his show, and now it's on him, and he is going to pick this next coach. And, you know, I believe she'll sign off on whatever he wants to do. But now John Robinson, who has been doing a good job of building this roster, picks the coach, and the Tennessee Titans are, you know, they are a product of everything he wants to do.
And it seems very clear, Joe Rexroad joining us here, that the quarterback is a big part is the biggest factor here. So what percentage of, you know, if you want to call it a percent, what percentage of the decision here from John Robinson when he's evaluating candidates is centered around Marcus Mariota?
Yeah, good question, Braden. I think a healthy percentage. That's the one thing that he kept saying, he probably said three or four times yesterday, was maximizing the ability. And, of course, I mean, it's been a year-long discussion or a season-long discussion around here, especially about Mariota and whether he's being misused and all that stuff. And, of course, I've been a naysayer of that whole mindset. Not completely. I mean, I don't think the coaches did a great job this year. I also don't think, like, there's no way that they could have reached him or that they could have, you know, found what they had last year. But that's obviously a big part of this. So the question is, does that mean the next head coach is going to definitely be an offensive guy? I don't necessarily think so, especially because when he was asked about attributes of the next head coach, the first thing he said was leader of men.
Right.
But I still think you could bring in, you know, a defensive coach, or, you know, with a defensive background, as long as you're happy with the offensive coordinator slash quarterback coach situation. So like a guy like a Mike Vrabel, to me, is an intriguing possibility here. And of course, Jim Schwartz is an obvious talking point as a guy who was here and has done great things and has been a pretty good head coach. But anyway, back to the original question, I do think that that's going to be central to all the interviews and discussions. What do you think of Marcus? What do you think his ceiling is? What do you think you can do with him?
Joe Rexroad of the Tennessean with us here on the morning show. Joe, one of the things everybody keeps pointing to is a huge bonus for anybody looking at this job is the fact that this roster is really good, starting with Marcus Mariota. And I keep looking at the roster that I watched for 18 games this season and wondering, is it as good as everybody thinks it is? We just kind of had this debate. I said, it's probably a top 12 NFL roster, maybe get in the playoffs, but certainly not where they got, which was the final eight this season. Where do you put this Tennessee Titans roster right now?
No, I agree with you. I think you're dead on. I think it's a good roster. They've got some good talent. I do not think this was like some incredibly talented roster that got mismanaged by the coaches. I just don't. I'll die on the hill. I'll die on the Malarkey Hill. But, you know, I think it's, you know, like defensively, they've got some good players. You know, Arakpo, Morgan, Casey. I think John Robinson did a good job upgrading the secondary. There's no doubt it was better. Byard is coming on as a really good player. But compare that defensive lineup to what the Jags have. I mean, I don't think
not close.
I think it's a good. Yeah, it's not. So I mean, it's good. It's a good solid defense, and I think that they have terrific offensive tackles. And you know, I like Mariota, and the backs are good. But I mean, you know, the receiving core. I mean, that's a big thing here when we talk about John Robinson and all these decisions that are going to shape, you know, his legacy and shape the direction of his career and how long he's the Titans GM. I mean, Corey Davis, how talented is he? I think he's talented. I think he's good. Is he number five pick good? You know, we're going to find that out. So I think you're right. It's a fringe playoff roster right now. And so that's pretty darn good to get to the final eight. But there's still a lot of work to do on that roster. And of course, it's going to get more difficult as you move forward and you have to pay Luan and you have to pay Mariota and some other things tighten up. Oh gosh, man, I swear I never mean to actually say tighten up, but half the time I'm talking about the Titans, I accidentally use that phrase. I'm sorry.
their marketing campaign is working on you, buddy.
It can happen.
Yeah,
it can happen.
Exactly. It's subliminal advertising. Jeez.
Joe, I do want to ask you this. I'm a pretty big believer in John Robinson. I think the job he's done to take the roster from 32nd best in the league to whatever, 12th, 13th best, wherever you have it, is a remarkable thing. But I also think he's sort of gotten completely a pass for what this roster looked like this year and the lack of the progression from last year. Am I way off there, or do you sense that the same?
Again, I mean, I don't want to completely agree with everything you say, Steve, but I have to, man. No, seriously,
man.
Yes. I think, you know, I think, look, Malarkey has been the fall guy from the start. And the default analysis has been, wow, I mean, it's not John Robinson. He's done an incredible job. He's a genius. Malarkey's messing this up. And you know, again, look, no GM's perfect. So you can nitpick picks all you want. I mean, I agree with you. Overall, you look at what he's done, I think he's done a very good job. But Kevin Dodd, man, that pick, if they could have that one back, You know, think of
Matt Castle starting at quarterback against the Dolphins.
Yeah, right.
Julian's never going to let that one go.
It's hard to have a team without holes, but I agree that, yes, for the most part, he has gotten a total pass, and that ends now. That's over now. I mean, now the people coaching these players are people he chose or he will choose here soon. And as we move forward, it'll be more, you know, we will be looking more at what he's done. But, yeah, I just think Mularkey, again, as Mularkey leaves town, I think he got a little bit of a raw deal here.
Joe Rexrode, very clear on his opinion, on his stance. And, Joe, I am firmly of the belief it can be both things, that he wasn't necessarily treated perfectly and did an excellent job and deserves more credit, but also he's not the guy to lead them to championships. So, Joe, always a pleasure, man. I'm going to let myself get the last word there because it's my show. Joe, take it easy, buddy.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, man. I do want to get into that, though, because Julian always mentions the Matt Castle, and many people point to that as a mistake by the GM. How about this? Let's look at the negatives that John Robinson. Let me ask you if we can maybe rank those, some of the biggest quote-unquote mistakes, if we want to call them that. There's not been a lot of them, but let's point out a couple of those with John Robinson when we come back and maybe give those a pecking order, if we will. Steve Lehman, Braden Gall here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. We'll get to Chris Mason here in just a second as we get ready for some Preds hockey talk coming up in just a few minutes. Steve Lehman, Braden Gall here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. And this is an interesting exercise to go through John Robinson, and let's say let's just be totally critical for the sake of being critical. We all believe in John Robinson, in the GM. We think he's the guy to lead this franchise, and we trust that he'll make the right decision. And he's made a lot of really good decisions. But let's go through some of the mistakes and let's rank the mistakes maybe. What has been, in your opinion, the biggest mistake John Robinson has made so far in his tenure?
The biggest. I think, honestly, to me, and I don't know how much this was a mistake because, again, I think he attacked weaknesses this past offseason. And so as opposed to looking at the roster as a whole, is where are we truly deficient? I'm going to go after those and try and shore them up somewhat. And so maybe it wasn't about making every little spot better. I think there were parts of the roster that he overlooked this year that he thought he could get by with. And that's maybe a mistake. But the biggest thing to me is the free agent signings this past season, other than Eric Decker, didn't pan out.
And Logan Ryan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Logan Ryan, including Eric Decker. Logan Ryan was the one that panned out, including Eric Decker. And he was solid. He did some good things for this team, but he was not the third down threat for the most part that you hoped. He was not the red zone threat at all that you were virtually guaranteed when he showed up with this team. I think Jonathan Cyprian, who last year was rated as like the seventh best safety in the NFL, didn't have nearly that type of an impact with this team. Sylvester Williams was supposed to be this huge stopgap guy to cut up offensive line and be great against the run. He had no impact for this team at all. So I think the moves last offseason didn't really help this team. They didn't get better with those moves.
It's funny. I think the two biggest decisions that I would point to and say those are the ones that I'm the most critical of. One is the second round draft picks of 2016. And I like Derrick Henry. I think he's a nice player. I think Austin Johnson came on late in the year and filling in for Daquan Jones. But for those three second round draft picks as a group to largely be backups 2 years into their careers, I think you could point to, it's not a waste because there's still lots of time to see if those guys develop. But I would point to those three picks as a package, as a group, the second round of the 2016 draft. I don't think you can look at any way and say huge success. I think Derrick Henry's had a good start to his career. Like I said, I think Austin Johnson has shown signs of life, and Kevin Dodd was not the player that he was drafted. Period. End of discussion. He's not had an impact on the team in 2 years as essentially a first round pick, the 33rd pick or whatever he was.
None of those guys have been second round values through 2 years.
Now, I agree that if you tell me that Jonathan Cyprian is the ninth highest paid player on the team and Sylvester Williams is the 10th highest paid player on the team, those two decisions to fill needs, those are also big mistakes in my opinion. Now, I thought that about I'll put my hand up and say, listen, I was sort of intrigued by Cyprian because he's a physical player who hits hard and could fill a need.
Sure.
And could cover tight ends. I thought that would be this thing. I never thought the Sly Williams signing was a good signing in any stretch of the imagination. So those two, Eric Decker didn't cost you a whole lot, brought some experience. You know, I can get by with that. But I think those are the two areas that I point to. And the Matt Cassel signing again, and you know, Julian brings this up all the time. It was not a very good decision to have Matt Cassel as your backup quarterback. No. But if Case Keenum is your quarterback, you win that game, and maybe you win a division, which is a really cool banner, and you hang that. But I still don't think you go any further in the postseason. I think you lose in the AFC divisional round. I don't think it has any impact really on the end game of the season. Because the bottom line is any team loses their starting quarterback for an extended period of time, you're not the same franchise.
There aren't very many backup quarterbacks that are very good out there in the league. That's certainly it. The other thing to point to, as you talk about going into year two, and I was critical of the free agency signings, but he had 9 draft picks last year. 4 of those guys aren't on the team anymore. And yep. Of the rest of them, obviously Corey Davis, you know, he looked great the other night. His limited impact is largely due to an injury, so you give him a pass there. I think Adoree Jackson was great. Taywan Taylor, Jonnu Smith, neither one of them were as productive as you would hope third-round picks would be coming into your offense.
Especially when you traded up to get one of
them. Yeah. The one guy that I think you look at and say, okay, that was a pretty good steal of a pick, is they got Jayon Brown in the fifth round. Yeah. He was a great guy for them on third down. They were better against tight ends this year. He's a big part of that, so that was nice. But, I mean, here's the thing. John Robinson did an incredible job, I think, in year one with his moves, whether you're talking about the trade for DeMarco Murray, whether you're talking about some of the free agency signings he did, whether they were stopgap
Rashard
and long-term
Matthews,
pieces.
Ben Jones.
Absolutely. He did an incredible job there. His draft,
trading picks in the draft.
The trading picks to leverage the number one pick to get Jack Conklin and get other picks. You can debate the guys he got in the second round there, but
right.
He hit on a bunch of other things in that first draft when he got Kevin Byard in the third round. I mean, that guy's an all-pro now. Tajay Sharpe was a factor last year. By the way, we forget that he just wasn't around this year because right. He was hurt for the entire season. LaShawn Sims was a fifth-round guy. He's still playing for this team. Aaron Wallace was a factor before he got hurt this year. Kalen Reed's still around. He was Mr. Irrelevant. I think he did a really good job in the first year. I think he did a way less good job in the second year, and people completely glossed over it because the expectation was the roster was already good enough. We need to be great. And here's what happened. The roster didn't get any better from year one to year two under John Robinson. And guess what? The team didn't get any better. And you know where all the fault went? It went on Mike Mularkey and the coaching staff, and I don't think that's completely fair.
I think there was some development there. I think the roster's more talented, to be honest with you. I think with Eric Decker and Corey Davis, Taylor and Smith, along with the receiving core, I think the receiving core is significantly more talented. I think the secondary is significantly more talented with Logan Ryan, Adoree Jackson, and Kevin Byard taking a step into the second year. So I think those moves, I do think there was more talent there, and they technically achieved the exact same record at 9-7, and they got into the postseason and won a playoff game. So it's hard to, I don't think that Mularkey gets the blame for all of this. What I think Mularkey gets the blame for is not being willing to be accommodating to the next step.
Oh. There's zero question about that.
That's clearly what this is all about to me. This isn't about, like, hey, let's blame Mularkey for what happened with the offense, or let's blame John Robinson or not blame John Robinson, or completely give John Robinson a pass. Like, to me, none of that really matters. Like, they as a group progressed in general as a franchise. Statistically, as an offense, they didn't. Now how do we address that?
Yeah.
And one guy wasn't willing to address that, and the other guy did. And that other guy is John Robinson, and Mike Mularkey didn't. So – Also, the re-signing of Jarrell Casey, I think, is to keep him around long term, is a big positive in his favor. Now, what he does with Taylor Lewan and what he does with Marcus Mariota in the next two seasons are going to be big. How do you get those two guys locked up long term? Those are things that are going to be on his shoulders as well.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And I think in some ways we're having two different discussions here. Is part of this is I think when you talk about the blame for this season from a fan perspective. I think that's where I was going with a lot of fans just put it on Mularkey and haven't even thought about John Robinson and just John Robinson's great. He's done nothing wrong. the reason we're talking about all this today is the fact they got rid of Mike Mularkey yesterday. That's because Mike Mularkey was unwilling to change.
Right.
If Mike Mularkey was willing to say, hey, I'll look at the offense. Let's talk about this. Let's see if there's a guy. Let's see if there's a direction we could go. If he's willing to have that conversation, I think there's a chance Mike Mularkey would still be the coach, and we wouldn't even be discussing this right now. But he wasn't, and that's why we're here.
The other thing you got to give him credit for, too, is I think even though Ryan Succop struggled down the stretch, I think he completely revamped the special teams. A huge weakness last year. He went out and signed two guys that both like to make tackles on special teams, and Trey Wick and Bates. He drafted Adoree Jackson to help fix the return game, and he had and Brett Kern developed into one of the best punters in the league. So I think Robinson and the coaching staff both deserve credit for addressing needs in that situation, because Mularkey had to fire Bobby April in the middle of the season last year.
Right.
So they went from one of the worst teams on special teams to one of the better teams on special teams.
Special teams were better. I'm not sure if I thought they were as good as I maybe hoped going into the year. Even guys like Bates and Trawick, who are good players and I think were good signings, I'm not sure they had the level of impact that I expected.
Especially if you're signing two guys to play essentially, like you're using two of your roster spots.
For just that.
I agree with that. And you need to find guys that do a little bit. I mean, Paul Posluszny for Jacksonville is making special teams tackles against the Titans. You need to find those guys. I know that's a veteran player, a different situation. But there are things that you can point to and say, you know what, John, but nobody bats 1,000 in this business. It's just not the way it works.
Oh, absolutely not. And he pointed that out yesterday. He said, look, sometimes you make or when people are talking about the risk of the decision, he certainly understands it, and we've laid that out on the program. He said, but everything in this business is a risk. When you make a trade with draft picks, when you trade for DeMarco Murray, they all have risk. He's right about that. But here's the thing. If you whiff on Kevin Dodd in the second round, or maybe don't make the most out of your second round picks, but you do other things in free agency in the draft, people will let all that slide and they'll think you're great. What he's coming up to in this decision, if he whiffs on this, no one's going to think he's great anymore.
Yeah.
If he hires a guy that flops here, all of a sudden John Robinson's in trouble.
And there's a lot of – they've got a lot of cap space and a lot of decisions to make in the near future. So there's a lot of room for him to screw it up, A, or – take this team to the next level, B. So as we started this whole conversation yesterday and have now continued it today, it's exclusively about John Robinson moving forward from here.
And there's reason to be confident about him in that regard, but here's the thing now, is the clock was always on Mike Mularkey of when things went wrong, he was done. Now the clock starts for John Robinson.
Chris Mason going to join us when we come back. The Predators are finally back on the ice. They play Vegas tonight. Victor Arvidsson leaving practice yesterday, a little gingerly day-to-day. Philip Forsberg, what's his status? And we'll take a look at the matchup tonight against the Vegas Knights with Chris Mason when we come back right here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. ESPN 102.5 The Game. You can follow us on Twitter, at Steve Lehman, at Braden Gall. Preds fans, don't miss Smashville Live Wednesday night at Tin Roof on Broadway. That is tomorrow night on this week's exclusive Preds Player Show. I will be joined along with Hal Gill, Cody McLeod, and Kyle Turris going to join us tomorrow night at, of course, Smashville Live. That's Wednesday night at Tin Roof coming up tomorrow night. Come out to Tin Roof on Broadway and meet the guys and have a great time. I promise you that. Chris Mason joining us here on the program. C. Mace, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you doing?
Hey, how you doing, guys?
So what do we expect after a long bye week? What sort of, is this a moment against a really big team and a good team and a high-quality opponent with a personal sort of tie-in with James Neal? Do we expect, extremely rested, fast-paced hockey right out of the gate, or is there some time to get sort of back into the rhythm?
Well, it's sometimes you never know what you're going to get. They're definitely going to be rested, but when you get into a game, and especially when you're playing a team as fast as Vegas, and it's going to be a high-flying game, it does take a little bit of adjustment, especially earlier on the first few minutes. Your legs feel great. But your hands and just the quickness and the way that players get on you quick and all the body checks and all that takes a few minutes to get in. But one thing they're gonna have a lot of rest. The guys that were playing that were banged up had a chance to recover physically, and you play most of the season. You're never really 100%. So this was a good opportunity for the guys to get healthy and and back at it for the second half.
Vegas has played just one game in the last week going into tonight as well, because they had their bye last week leading up to the weekend when they lost to the Oilers at home in overtime. So you should have two rested teams on the ice tonight. What do the Preds have to do, C-Mace, tonight to avoid what happened to them in Vegas when they just got, frankly, skated out of the building in that game?
Well, to me, this is, you know, obviously Vegas is a great story this year. Nobody expected this to carry on this long, and they're sitting atop, you know, the Western Conference in first place. And I think the biggest thing, the biggest strength, and which presents the most challenge against Vegas, and I've really noticed this in the Predator games too that they've played, is their neutral zone. They lock it down. When Nashville, their opponent, gets possession of the puck in Nashville's defensive end, if they don't have pressure, they back off and they try to get the puck back in the neutral zone, and they can fly. They have such great transition, great speed, so they make it really tough to get through the neutral zone. And Nashville is at their best when they're playing fast. They're skating through that neutral zone. They're executing plays. And I felt that both games that the Predators have played them, they've had trouble getting through the neutral zone, whether it's execution or Vegas doing a great job in that regard. So I think, to me, that's the key. And maybe, you know, you're going to have to change your game plan a little bit, or make sure that you're able to execute those highly skilled plays. But they make it tough because they clog it up in the neutral zone. So I think, to me, that's the biggest key. And then once you get through there, you're able to get into their end and play with the puck. But that's the biggest challenge that Vegas presents.
Obviously, Victor Arvidsson taken off the ice yesterday during practice. No information on the injury day-to-day. I'm assuming, let's go hypothetically here, that he's not going to play tonight or for, you know, a short period of time here. All that's doing now, C-Mace, is just putting even more pressure on Ryan Johansson to really elevate his game to the next level, is it not?
Yes, I think, you know, you have to look to your leaders. You have to look to your, you know, your best players, and Ryan Johansson is definitely one of those guys. He's capable of playing a physical brand of hockey when he wants to, and when he does, he's such a strong guy, and he has to play with that edge. And he's, now that, you know, you have two guys potentially out of the lineup, like you said, your highest offensive producers, you have to take that onus. You're going to have to shoot the puck, and you're going to have to carry more of the burden or the weight on your shoulders. But that's when good players rise to these occasions, and he's more than capable of doing that. I thought he played really well before the break, but now it's going to take a more concerted effort by him, and all the other guys are going to have to step up as well. But it certainly helps having Ryan Ellis back, because the Predators are capable of playing any kind of hockey you want. If you want to D up and play those low-scoring 2-1 type of hockey games, these guys are more than capable of doing that, and that may have to be the case. You know, the second half, it gets a lot tighter. A lot tighter games. You're not going to see as many of the 6-5, 5-4 type of hockey games. So, you know, I felt before the break there, even losing Phillip, I thought they did a better job of not giving up as many shot attempts, really, you know, keeping a lot of the play to the perimeter. So I think that they're going to have to continue, you know, to play more of that style of game. But you're definitely going to look to Ryan Johansson to pick it up on the score sheet.
Chris, the Predators play 7 of their next 8 games at home, 4 of 5 here in a stretch before they go in the All-Star break, where they get another little break here at the end of the month. As tight as the Western Conference is, how important is it for them to come out in this stretch, play some of their best hockey, and maybe make a little push here where they can get a break and they're on home ice?
Yeah, it's huge. You know, this is big. This is an opportunity for them to get those games in hand. You know, you look at the standings, they have 4 games in hand on Winnipeg and everybody else in the Central. So these are the games, and this is the part of the schedule where you're like, hey, guys, this is where we can make up ground. We're at home this whole month. If you don't win those games in hand, well, they're no good having them. So this is a big opportunity for the guys. Unfortunately, you know, we just touched on the fact you don't have Forsberg, you don't have Arvidsson, but the fact that this is one of the deepest teams in the league, and they've had a lot of guys step up this year and really take the next step in their careers. Kevin Fiala, Craig Smith having one of his best years. He's really having a great bounce back. So you have a lot of good guys up and down the lineup, you know, that are capable of stepping up. But this home stretch, you know, it's not the end of the world, but it's a good opportunity here. And I know that they're internally, they're expecting a lot of wins at home.
Well, to me, it's even more important, C-Mace, along those lines. It's like tonight, even though the weather's bad, it should be a pretty raucous crowd. You got the number one team in the conference coming in. You got James Neal coming in. Like, it's sort of there's baked in, intensity and focus. It's a little different when Arizona and Florida and some of these teams are coming in. How much as a coaching staff do you ever have a conversation looking ahead at something like that? I know it's one game at a time, one period of time, all that stuff, but like if you're a coaching staff and you're lobbying the guys, do you actually address a stretch like that with your players, or do you just say, hey, this is the only thing that matters is Vegas?
Well, I think, you might mention that. You say, hey, guys, if you're talking in general, that this is a big month, guys. We have, these many home games, just the stuff that we just talked about. But they, I know for a fact, they don't look past opponents. So it's once you start doing that, you get into trouble, your focus gets shifted on the big picture. Well, that's in the back of their minds for sure. They all know, the situation. Everybody knows the standings. They know that this month they're home the whole month and the breaks and all that. But you're definitely aware of the situation, but their focus is 100% on Vegas. And I'm going to guarantee, if you ask Peter Laviolette about the month, he'll make a quick comment, but say, hey, you know what? Our focus is on tonight. We played Vegas two times. They beat us twice. They're the top team in the Western Conference. That's where our minds have to be. And you have to agree with that, because once you start looking past that, you don't have the focus that you need to beat a team like Vegas.
C-Mace, always a pleasure, man. Thanks a lot, bud. We'll be listening and watching, and we appreciate your time, man.
Thanks, guys. Good stuff, and stay safe today.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody be safe out there. It's easy. I think what helps the Predators in this stretch where you're talking about at home, one of them's the best team in the league, the Tampa Bay Lightning. The other one, even though Tampa Bay would not normally be some sort of like big-time rivalry game that you would have focus on, Chicago normally would be, but they're the worst team in the division right now. But because they're Chicago, I think you're going to take them a lot more seriously. Rivalry game. Vegas, of course, has got the James Neal angle, so I think that helps.
Coyotes just beat you.
Those are the two that scare me, Arizona and Florida. Like, you have to maximize on opportunities when you're playing against the worst teams in the league like Arizona. You can't lose a point, even if it was on the road a couple of weeks ago. So, to me, New Jersey on the road, okay, that doesn't really have a lot of juice to it. I mean, it kind of just is what it is. Tampa has some baked-in intensity. Vegas has baked-in intensity. Chicago has baked-in intensity. It's Arizona and Florida that make me nervous. So I think the coaching staff would be lying if they weren't looking at this as a block. But to Chris's point, you got to focus on one game at a time.
Well, guys told me yesterday it is a block. They said, especially this first block, where you have five games, four or five at home going into the All-Star break, they want to maximize this opportunity, get as many points as possible. Then they get another little break to recharge for what will really then be the stretch run.
Yeah, and then after that, they you get Chicago, LA, and the Rangers all at home, which are all three big games.
And then
four straight on the road. So it's a lot of blocks and chunks of scheduling here coming up for the Predators. And, oh, by the way, don't forget, again, tomorrow night down at Broadway, at Tin Roof on Broadway, Cody McLeod and Kyle Turris going to join me and Hal Gill for Smashville Live. You don't want to miss that, starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. So get there early, have some questions ready to go, and we'll have a good time. When we come back, I want to get back into the latest with the Tennessee Titans coaching search. Candidates have been announced, not by the Titans, but by other people, been reported that they will be interviewed, and a couple of names are off the board. We'll wrap that up for you guys and get you set for another big night of hockey right here when we come back. Steve Lehman, Braden Gall, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Steve Lehman, Braden Gall here live from the Jack Daniels Barrel House at Bridgestone Arena. Of course, Julian Council producing back at the Game Nashville Studios, presented by Wholesale Inc. of Mount Juliet. Reminder, ESPN 102.5 The Game and 94.9 Game 2 is the home of MTSU Blue Raider basketball. Listen to MTSU basketball on 94.9 Game 2 Thursday versus Marshall with tip time at 7 p.m. and Saturday versus the rival Western Kentucky. Hilltoppers there at tip at 6 o'clock when in the borough. Make sure you tune in to 97.5 for the game broadcast and 95.1 for game two. Steve Lehman, Braden Gall. The candidates, however, that we think that are possibilities for the Titans, the name that obviously came up first and foremost yesterday when we found out that Mike Mularkey was going to no longer be the head coach of the Tennessee Titans, was, of course, Josh McDaniels. And it appears NFL Network and a few other people reporting yesterday in the afternoon that he has been essentially, you know, not officially, but will be the next head coach of the Indianapolis Colts, which again means that either the Titans were too late in the process or he values Andrew Luck over Marcus Mariota and maybe the roster or the situation of the GM or whatever. I think that's good news for the Titans, frankly. I don't think Josh McDaniels would have been a good fit here. I don't necessarily know if he's that good of a football coach to begin with. So that's one piece of information. The other couple of pieces of news are Pat Shurmur, the OC at Minnesota, looks like he's been earmarked for the New York Giants job, and it looks like Matt Patricia, the defensive coordinator of the New England Patriots, has been earmarked for the Detroit Lions job. This sort of all feels like Dan Quinn being named the head coach at Atlanta. Like, it wasn't official, but everybody sort of knew it was happening, and that's why Atlanta was willing to wait until, you know, Seattle had got done with their Super Bowl run that year. The other names that have come up that will absolutely be interviewed by the Titans, according to reports, Steve Wilks, the defensive coordinator for the Carolina Panthers. You've got Matt LaFleur, the offensive coordinator for the L.A. Rams, according to Gary Klein of the L.A. Times, and Mike Vrabel, the defensive coordinator at the Houston Texans. So that's what we know so far, all that information. Any of those three names, first of all, that you think are big misses that the Titans, had they fired Mularkey after the Kansas City game or had they not won that game, do you think that they missed out on? I think Pat Shurmur is the only one that interests me.
I like Shurmur a lot. He's my favorite of those guys for sure that seems to have another job lined up. There's a lot of people who are going to point to McDaniels. I don't know, personality is a great fit. The tie everybody's going to look at is the fact that they're both Patriots guys. He and John Robinson, they have a bit of a relationship. But I don't know for a fact that John Robinson had McDaniels in his mind when he was doing this. As I said earlier, I think John Robinson yesterday, it wasn't about having a guy necessarily already earmarked or that this is my guy in 2 weeks when I'm doing the introductory press conference. That's going to be the guy who's sitting next to me. As much as it was John Robinson saying, I have a clear direction for this team. Mike Mularkey wasn't willing to go in that direction with me. And so it's time to look for somebody else who will. And I think that's what yesterday was all about. It was time to move on, and John Robinson's going to find that guy. I don't necessarily think it was Josh McDaniels. I'm with you. I think that's okay. We'll find out where this goes.
I think it's a lot more Ken Wisenhunt than it is anything else, Josh McDaniels. You can read reports all you want to about what took place in Denver, and it's just not pretty. And then the 1 year for St. Louis, statistically, it was an awful year. They fell off a cliff. He's been very, very good when he's calling plays for Tom Brady and working for Bill Belichick. And
you would be too.
So was Eric Mangini and Charlie Weiss and Romeo Crennel. And they were all great when they worked for Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. So I don't think we know that much about Josh McDaniels, the football coach, except for what we've seen. I think from a personality standpoint, maybe he's matured and evolved. Somebody tweeted me yesterday and said, hey, Brayden, I hope you're right about Josh McDaniels because it looks like he's going to be the Colts coach and now you're going to have to play him twice a year. So if he is what I think, which I'm not a huge fan of Josh McDaniels as the hire, I would not be particularly excited about that if I was a Titans fan. I think that is potentially good news for Titans fans that he's going to Indianapolis. I do like Pat Shurmur a lot out of that group. Of the three names that we've learned that probably are going to be interviewed, as reported at least, allegedly, I think that Matt LaFleur is the most interesting one of the group because he's worked under Kyle Shanahan for a long time, worked with Matt Ryan, worked with Sean McVay. You could argue, hey, Sean McVay's the one calling the plays and Kyle Shanahan's calling the plays, but he's learning from some of the best, brightest minds. I think I like Vrabel a lot too, but then there's a major question about what the offense looks like. So, and I don't know a ton about Wilkes. He's in his first year as a coordinator in Carolina. They've had a good defense, so he's been good. I just don't know a lot about him.
That's the interesting thing to me about all those guys is essentially they're very young in their careers. None of them have been head coaches before, and by and large, they're all very young in the coordinator business. I mean, Wilkes is in his first year.
Vrabel, first year.
LaFleur out there. He doesn't even call the plays in that situation. So, you know, it's an interesting look at some of these guys. The names have come up. John DeFilippo is another guy whose names come up.
That's an interesting one to me. I like that name.
So there's a lot of guys here, I think, who
– never even called plays yet, though,
right,
in his career.
So, I mean, I think all these guys that we're hearing right up front, they're guys that are viewed as brilliant minds and sort of innovative minds, which I think Titans fans would embrace. But they're also all guys who frankly, haven't been complete coordinators and certainly have never been head coaches before, have very limited experience in the coordinator realm. And so it is kind of a guess out there. And that's where if you're a Titans fan and you believe in John Robinson, which I do, given what he's done over the long haul in his 2 years as general manager, is you just put the trust in him that he knows what he's going after and he's going to find it.
Yeah, it should be very interesting. John DeFilippo is an interesting one. He's the quarterback's coach at Philadelphia. Frank Reich, the OC at Philadelphia, also being mentioned. But I think one of those guys has to be the odd man out, because if most people are giving credit, most experts out there are giving credit to John DeFilippo as being the guy who developed Carson Wentz, and Doug Peterson, the head coach, is the guy calling plays, where does that leave Frank Reich? That's where I sort of am hesitant to get on board with that decision. I'm not so sure about him in this conversation. But John DeFilippo is, you know, there's rumors that if they were to go after Steve Wilks, the defensive coordinator from Carolina, that he would be bringing DeFilippo with him as his offensive coordinator. So there's an answer to a question already, that if you can go get Mike Vrabel, who I think is going to be a pretty good head coach in this league at one day, I'm not sure when that day is, I actually think that's a really good hire. There needs to be a pretty distinct and definitive plan on offense in place if you're going to go get a guy like Mike Vrabel.
It sounds like Vrabel's killing every interview that he does with people. Just really, really impressive. And we heard Joe Rexroad say earlier that he doesn't think John Robinson necessarily has to get an offensive coach if he knows what he's after. If he thinks the best coach is a defensive guy, he can do that, and they can find together the offensive mind to get the offense in the direction they want it to go.
Which maybe is a better way to ease a guy like DeFilippo or maybe Matt LaFleur into that job is, hey, we're not giving you the head coaching. You know, Vrabel's more prepared to be the head coach. You're more prepared to take the reins of the offense. If a guy's not ready to be the head coach, does that make sense? Like, you're not asking
Yeah, but
you're
do
not
you get those
him.
Guys to move for that type of a job at this point?
Yeah.
Given where they are and what they've already done and the way people view them around the league, that's a question. The only concern I have about
To get out from under McVay, who calls the plays, you know what I'm saying? Like, you want to move out and call your own offense. I mean, that's a
– I get that.
There's a lure there.
The only question I have, if you're going to the defensive side of the ball, whether it be Vrabel, Wilks, or somebody else, is then you're taking a leap of faith to hire a head coach, a first-time head coach. You're also then taking sort of the leap of faith together of going out and trying to find the offensive coordinator to be the best for Mariota. I know it works the other way if you hire an offensive guy too, but the biggest concern on this team right now.
But Dick LeBeau's then out of there altogether then, if you hire a Mike Vrabel type, I'm assuming.
Sure, sure. But Dick LeBeau may be out anyway because he's going to be 81 years old and who knows. Right. But the thing is, the biggest need on this team right now is offense. And Marcus Mariota, I think my focus would be finding that offensive guy to take you in that direction and go from there.
Yep, I totally agree. Steve, always a pleasure, man.
You bet. I'll see you Thursday.
Love hanging out with you, man. You'll be back with us on Thursday. Preds back on the ice tonight, of course, at 7. Puck drop then. Pre-game coverage at 6, live from the Barrel House. We'll have coverage of all the latest and breaking news in the Titans coaching search as well. For Steve Lehman, for Kevin Kyle Engineering, for Julian Council Producing, my name is Braden Gall. We'll be back tomorrow to go deep into some new names in this coaching search, some outside-the-box thoughts on the coaching search for the Tennessee Titans. We'll do that tomorrow. 3D coming up next. Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been The Morning Show on ESPN 102.5 The Game.